day will come when your phone is broken or dead and you're stranded in a remote, desolate location, like Schaumburg, and you're going to have no idea where you are and how to get out of there. You will find yourself a day late, yay, and a dollar short because you lost the use of your map. I just don't want to be caught in that predicament. I read an article recently that said a new kind of robot car is coming on the market soon that literally drives itself. But I don't want any help driving. Driving well in concert with all of the other people driving well, or at least trying to, feels good. It feels like we're participating in society. We're present in the moment as we share the road with one another, passing on the left, waving for one another to go ahead and pull out of that driveway, giving one another a spirited middle finger salute. When will it end? I found the infantile grown-ups in the great film Wall-E to be poignantly frightening. Fat, mewling adult larvae floating about in cradle chairs, being fed their daily pap in the form of only blended shakes. Orwell predicted that shit, and it scares me to death. Here's my trip. Our cool new technologies provide us with a surplus of convenience, and it seems to me that an overabundance of convenience leaves us with a surplus of leisure time. Our technologies then provide us with a panoply of choices, of ways in which to fill that time, like video games, social networking, vapid television and film content, etc. We thereby end up spending money and time upon their diversions, when we could have been just performing all of the simple acts that our technologies are saving us from in the first place. Driving our vehicles, looking at our maps, fishing, walking in the woods, doing the dishes, splitting firewood. That's living, plain and simple, and I feel like a crotchety old man saying this, but there's a great satisfaction in a drying rack full of dishes that cannot be found on Twitter or Scrambly Town. By all means, we should use these wonderful new tools in all the wonderful ways that we can, but we should also be wary that they don't begin to consume us, devouring our time and money that could be better spent on a mouth-watering stack of quarter-sawn oak planks. The weather seems to be getting more severe all over the world. Global warming is a clear and present issue, perhaps even an imminent danger. The human race is always a potential powder keg, requiring merely one single crackpot firebrand anywhere in the world to instigate a full-on shit fight. So, just in case some shit goes down, I will feel better knowing that I have the use of a map and a shovel and an axe. My mom and dad are much more than parents and grandparents. They are, between them, gardener, tailor, woodworker, cook, baker, labor and delivery nurse, school teacher, and much more. My dad taught me to read a map and to take full advantage of the knowledge it conveys. The happiness and productivity I have seen amassed by them in their lives is all the proof I need that GPS is for the birds. Chapter 13. Resurrection. I had blown through L.A. and back a few times before moving my toolkit permanently to the City of Dreams, so in my Chicago circle of fools, I was the expert on Hollywood. A sad state of affairs, considering how incredibly ignorant I was about the place. Leaving the Defiant Theater behind seemed impossible at the time, but it didn't look like I would have to. One of our next productions was to be action movie The Play, conceived, of course, by Joe Faust and Ragsdale, and it was one of the funniest high-octane romps you could ever hope to see on a stage that didn't also include Bugs Bunny and Gwar. The plan was for the show to be produced in Chicago, then travel to Los Angeles, where it would be such a smash hit. Who better to flock to a theatrical send-up of action films than the people who make action films? that we would certainly be moved to the Hollywood Pantages Theater, and then probably to Broadway, on our way to the West End, which is a part of London where the best theater in the world occurs, according to some white folks. It was an amazing plan, and flawless, really, except for the fucking goddamn flaws in it. When my theater company mates told me they would be traveling our show to California, they didn't take into account the simple truth that they did not, in fact, want to go to California. Oops. It was an honest mistake on their parts, by which I mean I don't think they knew their true hearts in the matter until push came to shove. Some of them wanted to bow out of the business altogether, some thought the idea of a tour imprudent, which it most certainly was, but then wasn't the whole Megillah? And a couple were just chicken. I'm certain it was smart of them to walk on by the L.A. tour, but doing things the smart way was not what had made us an exciting young Chicago company. We were not going to get to the West End by being smart. What I loved about these men and women, these gorgeous rascals, was precisely that we did not do things the smart way. Idiots. Whatever the case, the damage was done. Defiant Theater was staying home in Chicago. I was alone in Los Angeles. At least I had some friends in town, some of whom had small jobs for me to do, like acting on a minor Nickelodeon show or carpentry projects, or art department or PA, production assistant work. But I was without a stage upon which to ply my troth. Many people recommended shows for me to see, claiming that this theater company or that was really a lot like Defiant, and so I would go running all over town to see production after production, some mediocre, some god-awful, but nothing remotely like the Defiant flavor I craved. I began to drink to even greater excess. I would go to a bar and think, "Aha! Who's smart now, motherfuckers?" before vomiting into an empty pint glass. "But enough about theater, you crybaby. How about the biz, huh, bro? You didn't come here to do some kabuki bullshit. You came here to get on Baywatch and shit. Cowabunga, dude!" My subconscious, which had been very into The Simpsons, was speaking to me in such a derisive tone, but my subconscious was flat wrong. Like an absolute dullard, I had come to L.A. to do theater, at least among other things. One way or another, theater was just about all I could do. What I had failed to learn through my zero piles of research was that L.A. effectively had no theater community. Sure, there are theaters in L.A., but compared to Chicago's big-shouldered strength, they are pretty weak tea. Foolishly, I had assumed that the largest concentration of acting and writing talent in the country would have a healthy theater scene, but that is sadly not the case. It's a vicious circle in which there is not a large theater-going audience, so nobody does theater, so nobody goes, etc. I am being slightly unfair. Of course, there are talented people putting up plays in L.A. I can't fairly make such sweeping generalizations because I have never seen all of it. Nobody has. L.A. is so spread out that you would need to make viewing theater a full-time job in order to canvas the entire area, from Venice and Santa Monica to Pasadena, and from the Deep Valley or even Ventura down to Orange County. The point is, it was as bleak to me when I landed here as it possibly could have been. I saw more plays that were written by a person trying to get a job writing for friends, plays that seemed like just a 70-minute episode of a sitcom on stage, than I care to say. It turned out that moving to L.A. to work in theater was the logical equivalent of moving to Chicago to work in television. As usual, I had more than my share of dumb luck to buoy me. While I'd been in Chicago, a great casting director named Tracy Kaplan had gone to bat for me aplenty, and then she sent me to L.A. with a list of contacts with whom I could get in touch. She was vouching for me. From her list, I landed at a small but very nice agency, Progressive Artists, Bernie and Bell. I also scored a manager named Eve Brandstein, who taught me a lot about the business, before going back to her first calling as a casting director. I'm very grateful to all these folks for getting me off to a running start. They hooked me up with meetings at networks and studios, and I promptly repaid them by falling flat on my fat face. The executives in these meetings generally had no interest in, nor ability to comprehend, a theater resume. They'd look at my very nice resume like it was written in Greek. "Oh, Steppenwolf," they'd say, or, "Oh, wow, Shakespeare." Those were the two words they knew. It was really frustrating. We'd just look at each other, mutually puzzled by my presence in their offices. I learned later that in these moments, I was expected to be cute, or winning, or electric. I was supposed to turn up my X factor and come across all fuckable, which I am afraid I did not do. I had always done just fine by working on plays in which people would see me, and then on occasion some of those people would put me in their next play. "And we need a big dumb guy who falls down good. Hey, what about this guy? We'll put him in our play." Like that, pretty much. I mean, that system wasn't going to work in L.A., apparently, so I quickly found myself beating my head against the wall. As is well known, the business can be really shitty, especially when a person is just starting out. This did not take me completely by surprise, and I was not so naive that I thought I would cakewalk into a successful career without eating some shit first. More surprising was the ugliness that arose in my social life. All my friends and acquaintances from Chicago would get together for drinks at watering holes specifically peopled by ex-Chicago actors who wanted to commiserate about how hard the business was. The status of our auditioning lives and our callbacks became our conversational commodity. When we would see our friends, that's what they would ask about, rather than health or family or anything else. It would be, "Hey man, what's up? Are you going out?" Which means, "Are you getting any auditions?" They couldn't wait to come to the bar if they had any such information to share, and then they'd play it really cool. Yeah, I'm going in to read for ER, no big. And if they got a call back for a second reading, maybe for the producers, that was exponentially more valuable. One's true friends would be thrilled about any such achievement, while the majority of the Chicago pals would seethe with envy. Schadenfreude was easily the most popular cocktail served in those establishments. This circumstance quickly became really unpalatable to me. I began to eschew the scene, opting for smaller gatherings with friends, at which we'd cook inexpensive meals and bemoan our collective lots to more sympathetic ears. In my desperation, I actually designed the set and puppets for a Defiant show in Chicago, built most of them in Hollywood with a couple of pals, then hauled them all with my toolkit to Chicago in, you guessed it, a drive-away pickup truck. Some of my L.A. gang generously tried to hook me up with a couple of dates with cute ladies, dates that could only be described as laughably terrible. I remember one specifically with this cute actress named Elizabeth. I took her to dinner at Lola's, and I'm sure I looked like I was fresh off the construction site to begin with. She said, "What do you do?" Which is L.A. speak for, "What can you do for me, and how can you help me get a leg up on everybody else?" I said to her, "Well, I don't do much. I just moved from Chicago, where I've got a theater company, and we're actually doing this Carol Churchill play called The Skryker that I'm designing the set for, and heading up a team that's building 25 puppets and a bunch of masks," by which point she was out the door. Things weren't going great. Fortunately, my main squeeze, Pat Roberts, was in a similar boat as an artist, feeling underappreciated and underutilized. He had no interest in playing the commercial art game and chasing the girls. I mean, don't mistake me, we were definitely interested in the chasing of the girls. It's just that the girls we were meeting were not of the most appetizing variety. Once in a while, we'd meet an amazing woman, and, as if by a rule, she would be married or gay. So, wisely, we began to stay home and drink a lot of bourbon. At a certain point, I realized that I was not cut out for the self-promotional part of this industry. An unbelievable amount of money changes hands every day in Hollywood, forked over by hopeful performers with a dream, desperate for any slight inch of advantage they can beg, borrow, or steal to put themselves nearer the top of somebody's list. These monies are greedily received by countless photographers, acting coaches, and shyster agents and managers who promise the secret to gaining such inches. It was immediately clear to me that I didn't want to succeed at anything by buying an inch or by convincing an executive in his or her office that I was cool. So I made up my mind to ignore the business. I got work fabricating stuff for people, like building an editing bay and some props for the small animation company I was friendly with. Thanks to my minor connections, I started getting sporadic acting jobs here and there. Every few months, I'd score a guest star job on a TV show or a little part in a movie, and these tidbits were just enough artistic food to sustain me. I began to describe my career as a very slowly, ponderously slowly rolling snowball. Like all aspirants, besides my theatrical agent, film and TV, I had a commercial agent for advertising jobs. I was giving it the old college try while maintaining my uniqueness. I loved driving straight to an audition from a job site covered in sawdust and sweaty, because I knew that I was guaranteed to stand out from all of the adorably coiffed cute guys. One of the pearls of wisdom the agents would gift a body if one was trying to break in as an actor in L.A. was, record a videotape of every show that's on TV. Be sure to watch one episode of every show so that when you go to audition for that show, you'll know what they want, what style they're looking for. My response came quite easily. I said, tell you what, I'm not gonna do that. I'm not gonna watch any fucking shows. I'm not taping Angel and Buffy to formulate how I can better play a demon when I audition for them. That way, you'll have 100 guys doing what they think the producers want, but you'll have at least this one guy doing something original. That was my technique. I stand by it. Did I ever get a job as a demon on Angel? I did not. And after some time went by, I learned that many initial rejections should eventually be taken as compliments. A lucky actor learns that the projects one says no to end up being much more important than the jobs one takes. Outside of TV and film auditions, my time was spent traipsing to commercial auditions and working as a carpenter. Invariably, I'd be working on the east side of L.A., and the commercial audition would be far to the west in Santa Monica, which can often mean an hour of travel. One commercial reading could be a 3 or 4 hour commitment, an ordeal of at least half a day, sometimes more, if one would hopefully be asked to stick around so the director can see you. It didn't take me long to begin adding up these hours, for which I was not getting paid as a carpenter. Even though I did shoot a couple of minor commercials, the total profits did not eclipse the amount of carpentry income I was missing to attend the auditions. Well, this was just foolish. The only point of chasing commercials was to garner a paycheck. But if the whole process was losing me money in the end, what was the point? Understandably, I started to find the commercial auditions really depressing. At least in an acting audition, you have the possibility of your talent or your training getting you the job. Hey, this guy's really good at acting, naturalistically portraying the story. He's funny. Or he's really scary or really clumsy or whatever was right. They could look at your resume and see that you were a trained professional, meaning that there was a good chance you'd be more dependable on a 14-hour shoot day. But in commercial auditions, you're in a room with 100 fucking yahoos, and basically whoever could make the right funny face got the job. The only qualification necessary to get into this audition was that one look like he enjoys beer, or tits, or Doritos. It didn't take me long to ken that any joker could get the job. I began to comprehend that I was different from all these guys, simply because I could earn money with my tools. Their ineptitude in finding any other gainful employment filled the waiting room with an atmosphere of desperation. They were led there, Pied Piper-like, bewitched by so many stories like, "Hey, Lauren got a Chevy campaign last year, and he ended up making 600 grand. He bought a condo and a boat, and etc." The foyers of commercial casting offices are festooned with visions of sugar plums dancing. I had been briefly beguiled by these pipe dreams as well, but I was beginning to get wise. I began to limit myself to national as opposed to regional commercial auditions that promised a big payday, like the ones for banks, beer, or automobiles. I had been in town for about a year when I found myself auditioning for a Budweiser spot. I hauled my ass out to Santa Monica, the same old waiting room full of maybe 60 guys. It's a big square room, and each wall has a bench along it, so it's a big square of guys. Mostly beer-loving, baseball-fan-looking guys, so fat guys. The shtick was, you're in the bleachers, looking down at the outfield, holding two huge beers at a baseball game, and you hear the sound of a home run crack off the bat. The crowd noise builds, and you're watching the home run. It's coming straight at you. You look at your two beers, and you don't want to set either down because Budweiser is so delicious, or because ballpark beers are so expensive. So the home run hits you on the forehead, and you make a hilarious face, and then you fall over. So the salient question was, who makes the funny face of getting hit on the head with a home run ball the best? The Bud spot also contained the role of a little old peanut vendor, so there was a motley throng of hedonist-looking guys, the beer drinkers, together with a bunch of assorted little old men. I was looking around, calculating the carpenter wages I was not earning, and I realized that sitting next to me was Donald Gibb, who played Ogre in Revenge of the Nerds. I was the appropriate age for Revenge of the Nerds to have been a hugely beloved movie for me. He was also in the movie Bloodsport, for mercy's sake. This guy was a hero to me and every other teenager in the 80s, and now he was sitting next to me at this commercial audition? I thought, good God, you can be this minor movie star and do a ton of TV roles, and then 10 years later you're sitting next to me at a fucking Budweiser spot? I was truly reeling, so I got up and walked around the room to clear my head. Across the room, I passed another guy whose face rang a bell, and I looked back, and I'll be goddamned if it wasn't fucking Carmine from Laverne and Shirley. I surreptitiously looked at the headshot in his hand, and at the bottom it read, Eddie Carmine Mecca. I was dumbstruck, thinking, you've got to be fucking kidding me. It might as well have been John Schneider from The Dukes of Hazzard or Burt Reynolds. You can be fucking Carmine, and now you're at this Budweiser spot? Just then, Carmine started up a conversation with the little old man next to him. Hey, you're Joey such and such. You were in Guys and Dolls and Singing in the Rain. This Joey was apparently an old song and dance man with whom Carmine was very impressed. In a grinning reply, the man said, "Ah, come on, Eddie, you saw that shit? Forget about it." Fate, that fickle bitch, was grabbing me oh so firmly by the short hairs and sending me a very clear message. I ran out to a payphone, called my commercial agent, and said, "Thank you kindly, but I'm not doing this anymore. This is not the life for me." There is no shame in these commercial auditions. I just knew that I would rather be making a solid 20 bucks an hour than making zero money to sit and wait for a lottery ticket that could pay off big. I understood in that moment what Robert Mitchum had meant when he said, "Acting is no job for a man." Years later, I got to work with Eddie Mecca on an episode of Children's Hospital, and he was a dreamboat. Between takes, he would sing standards and Sinatra tunes, and he was an absolute peach. Now, if I could only shake hands with Ogre, I could bring my Budweiser trauma to a neat resolution. Okay, I had quit doing commercials, but I was still incredibly depressed and drinking a lot. Baby steps. Pat and I were having a lot of fun being young drunks in L.A., but we realized with each passing day that we weren't really getting to utilize any of the talents we had. We did things for fun, like watch Dawson's Creek, ironically. We'd run around the house saying, excitedly, "Oh my God, it's Tuesday night," and we'd sing, "I don't want to wait for my life to be over," and get all giggly. Of course, without irony, we loved the American institution, The Simpsons. Pretty much my entire circle of artistic friends couldn't help but be profoundly influenced by the genius of The Simpsons writers and animators. South Park as well, but The Simpsons was, and still is, like an encyclopedia of comedy. By now, there's literally no joke they haven't done three ways, and so we often turn to that venerated cartoon when we need a reference for any bit. Every two or three months, something really exciting would come my way, which would usually end in disappointment. To wit, in 1998, I was up for the lead in a movie entitled The Tao of Steve. In fact, the director led me on for a couple weeks that I had won the part when she had me in to read with other actors, but then they found out they could get Donald Logue, a great actor who had some buzz around him. I believe she sincerely thought I was going to be her choice, but the communication was left in a bit of a gray area because, as was often the case with me, they found me to be an adequate choice but were still hoping they could get someone who was more exciting at the time. So, when they actually did find a more exciting actor, she had to sit me down and give me a talk. She was trying to save face in an unfortunate situation, but didn't do terribly well when she handed me the lamest line ever. "You're more Gary Cooper, and he's more Montgomery Clift, which is more what this story needs." As though I would think, "Oh, well, I was crushed, but since you compared me to Gary Cooper, no hard feelings." I wonder if Donald knows what a powerful Monty Clift vibe he has going on, because he might be able to parlay that into at least a biopic at some point, right? The character was supposed to be really overweight and schlumpy, and Donald Logue did have a few pounds over me at the time, which didn't help my case either. Unfortunately, thinking I was going to be making this film, I had begun to happily gain weight, putting on 20 pounds over 3 or 4 weeks with Pat's gleeful assistance. In fact, you might say that he made me his project. I ate so much fucking ice cream and so many cheeseburgers that I thought I would clog my circulatory system right into an early grave. We had just seen an episode of The Simpsons in which Homer found out that if he weighed 300 pounds, he could go on disability. So he started wearing muumuus around the house, and there was this great joke that your food's caloric level wasn't high enough unless you could rub it against a piece of paper and have the grease turn the paper clear. Homer even says to Bart at one point, "Every second I'm out of bed, I'm burning precious calories." It was as though my very own guide for weight gain had been personally delivered via the genius of The Simpsons. So, obviously, I started wearing a muumuu, purchased just down the hill at the Rite Aid, and packing on weight just like Homer. I started quoting the lines from The Simpsons to our oblivious neighbors and the mailman. Getting fat was the greatest. Then suddenly, I wasn't getting the job, and I had become overweight, and so that, of course, just made me even more depressed. Rather than take the weight right back off again, I chose to shrug and continue trudging through the hard-won life lessons of a young man, now husky, in Hollywood. Meanwhile, I was starting to more consistently land dependable character actor gigs. I won a role on ER, which was very exciting as it was the highest profile drama on television at the time. It was to be the first live episode of ER, and so they wanted theater actors because the show would be shot more like a live play than a film. Since it was live, we couldn't stop and do it again if a mistake was made, so they wanted a cast who could hopefully avoid mistakes. It was an incredibly exciting event of which to be a part. A year or two later, I was on the 5th episode of The West Wing. This was quite bolstering, this opportunity to work on these shows that had some prestige. Even winning a little guest star part says to a fella, "You have worth. Stick around, maybe next time you'll do 3 episodes. I kept getting these invaluable little signals from the business that said, "Stick it out, kid, just keep plugging away, something good'll happen." Casting people would say things like that to me, too. One benevolent lady told me, "Look, you're gonna do great when you come into your sheriff years. Grow a mustache, and you're gonna work like crazy." I wish I could see her now and shake her hand. I was about due for some good news when suddenly I got some. A great theater company from Chicago called Roadworks out of Northwestern University was coming to town with a production of Mike Leigh's Ecstasy. They needed to replace a naked drunk guy in the show, and somebody said, "Hey, Offerman's in L.A. Perfect." So we staged this play at the Odyssey Theater, which I found to be an excellent and dependable, still today, Los Angeles institution. And let me tell you, that work put a powerful healing on me. Casting directors came to see us because the company had a great reputation, and I was able to ride on their coattails. Mally Finn, a generous and sublime casting director, sadly no longer with us, showed up, as did a few other great casting directors. Thank my lucky stars, some of these ladies saw something unique in me and began to champion me. For years, they would bring me in on auditions and try to get me some really nice jobs. It took a long time, but I began to see more and more fruit from their efforts. The best thing that happened immediately was that two casting directors, the same ones from The Tao of Steve, Nicole Arbusto and Joy Dixon, two of my greatest champions, whom I love to death, were casting this film called Treasure Island, written and directed by a genius guy named Scott King. It was a delightfully peculiar script, written more like a theater piece than a film, so they were leaning towards some theater actors. They ended up casting me and one of the lead actors from our production of Ecstasy, the heroic Lance Baker, as the leads of the movie, and then they cast the lead actress from the play, a winsome Rachel Singer, in a supporting role. I suddenly had a lead role in a movie. A hilarious, weird, and smart movie, and I was in heaven. The filmmakers were old-timey people. A sort of revival movement. 15 years ago, in L.A., there was the sect of hipsterish people who would dress in old-timey fashions like from the big band era. Double-breasted suits and fedoras and poodle skirts and such. Every Friday night at the Brown Derby, there would be big band music and swing dancing. They would use pomade in their hair and have DA haircuts and the whole nine yards. Scott King was sort of an adjunct to this crowd, but he held himself apart from it and therefore above it. He had come into some money, so he whimsically fashioned himself as an old-time studio head with his company King Pictures. He had a 1932 BMW convertible that he drove around, and he was very generous with all of us working in his company. We had a lot of fun, both shooting the film and socializing outside of it. I had finally found an artistic circle in which I could hang my hat, and a benevolent leader whom I could serve with ardor in Scott, a good friend of mine to this day. We shot in a studio in Silver Lake on a period camera called a Mitchell. The movie was set in 1943, and a Mitchell was the actual camera one would have used in the 40s. Scott ran a very civilized set, insisting that we only shoot 8-hour days. I loved working with him and the producers. Treasure Island was also where I first met my good friend, Austin filmmaker Bob Byington, who was the script supervisor on the film. Speaking of Bob, I ended up making a couple of prosthetic penises for the movie because they didn't have anyone else who could, and I had made a lot of stuff like that for the theater in the past. We also shot a week up in San Francisco, including some amazing locations in the city and in front of the Bay Bridge. It was such an incredible feeling to finally have the lead in a movie that reminded me of the Defiant Theater in its combined irreverence and intelligence. These people valued me as an actor, but also as a dependable contributor. I consulted on acting scenes, drove the art truck, rigged lights, and more, which did myself worth a world of good. The movie went to Sundance in 1999, and it really got us a lot of nice attention. We were awarded a special jury prize for distinctive vision. I finally felt like things were beginning to sputter to life for me in Los Angeles. The snowball began to pick up speed, almost imperceptibly, but still, that was a good sight better than slowing down and melting. Not long after this small triumph, planted in front of Dawson's Creek one night with our preferred dinners, a can of Virginia blister peanuts and a mason jar full of Jim Beam, water, and ice, Pat and I were undoubtedly feeling romantic after seeing what those rascals Pacey and Dawson were up to. We observed, "Okay, this is pathetic. There's gotta be some high-quality women in this town looking for us. We've met a lot of ladies, we've seen how this town works now. We're smart, after a manner of speaking, and we know that we have unique, weird talents and personalities. There are definitely ladies of refined taste looking for us. We just gotta find them." Well, I'll be goddamned if that speechifying didn't work, as though we had uttered some sort of necromantic, romantic incantation. Isn't that the secret? You just say what you want out loud and it comes to you? Had some arcane Kabbalah from a random episode of Oprah infiltrated our psyches? Whatever the case, secret or no, within 2 weeks of saying it, Pat met his future wife, Courtney Valenti, who is a magnificent, beautiful, tasteful woman who also happens to be a brilliant film executive at Warner Brothers and classy as all get out. It had happened exactly like we wished in our secret. Thank you, Dawson. Peace, Pacey. Through the cloud of smoke and patina of Silver Lake dirt, she was able to see the best version of Pat, in effect saying, "You are a brilliant, good-looking guy. Your artwork is somehow simultaneously hilarious and acutely intelligent, and I am laying claim to you." And she was right. They have two amazing kids now, and Pat is a champion dad and husband, even as he continues to crank out uproarious, thought-provoking art. Before we knew it, they were an item. Shortly after Pat and Courtney started dating, maybe a couple of months later, I was telling my friends, "Guys, ladies, I'm losing my mind. I have to do a play. That's my mother's milk. It's the only thing that can save my life." Once again, my heroic casting directors, Nicole and Joy, who had put me in Treasure Island, hooked me up with an audition for a play at a new company called The Evidence Room, which had just purchased a building in the Echo Park area. They needed to build a theater in this old warehouse, and they also needed to build a set for the show. There was a character in the play who was an East German soldier who had a monologue at one point comparing his anus to his phallus. I said to them upon our meeting, "You don't know it yet, but you are looking for me." It turned out that an actress named Megan Mullally, who was one of the stars of a popular television comedy entitled Will and Grace, was cast in the lead of the play. This fact was dangled as an incentive when I was meeting the directors of the company, but I said, "Hey, I'm a man of the theater, so I'm not that crazy about working with a TV lady, but I'm gonna audition despite the fact that you're planning to include her." Regardless of that jackassery, I got the job. And it, and indeed she, saved my life. The show was The Berlin Circle by Chuck Mee. He takes Bertolt Brecht's Caucasian chalk circle and sets it at the Berlin Wall coming down. During the first read-through, the cast of 24 people was sitting in a large circle of chairs in this empty warehouse when Megan came walking in, all turned out and wearing very cute clothing and what I used to call her fashion shoes. She was beautiful, okay. Sure, and I thought, "All right, let's see what you got, hotshot." We read through the script, and my attitude and, well, everything changed. She was so funny and so masterful. Such a total pro that she immediately went from seeming like some sort of TV actor with my own imagined inadequacies to clearly existing as a living, breathing, gorgeous pack of talent. Adroitly extinguishing my misplaced snobbery was the discovery that she had done two Broadway shows by that point. To my further embarrassment, I was to learn that she had cut her teeth in the exact same Chicago theater community as my own snotty ass just some years before me. Beyond that, she was simply hilarious. I am still so besotted by her talent that 13 years into our relationship, I'm amazed that I'm the partner to such a bright and shining powerhouse of entertainment. In the play, I was doing a sort of cheap Colonel Klink German dialect from Hogan's Heroes, which thankfully she found funny. After the read-through, I went up to her thinking, "Of course, you fool, they have good people on TV, too." My first words to my future bride were, "Hey, I'm Nick. You're hilarious, and I think this is going to be really fun." Little did I realize how effective this opening salvo would prove. As it turned out, literally no one else spoke to her that day because they were all freaked out by loving her on TV. So my humble greeting turned out to be a huge windfall, unwittingly. We had a lot of factors working against our becoming a couple. A rule I believe I've mentioned, one doesn't date another actor in one's play. Of course, we all end up breaking that rule, obviously, at some point, but everybody knows better. If you have your shit together and you're an adult, but you're feeling randy toward a castmate, you might make your urgings known to each other, but you simply wait until the play is over to seal the deal. Otherwise, chances are you're just signing up for little more than an afternoon delight, which can also be a pleasing option. I guess my point is that if you feel strongly enough about your fellow actor that you want to try to make a go at something lasting, then your amour has a better chance of surviving if you cultivate it outside of the theater, ideally after the play closes. Beyond that rule of thumb, we were also both staunchly single. Despite the matchmaking glamour that Pat and I had conjured together a few weeks before, I was still being protective of myself because L.A., and her cute, superficial women had been very painful to me thus far. Megan was extra self-protective because she was on a popular TV show, and I'm sure she had prospecting gold diggers at every available turn. She had been dating guys who were slightly more rock and roll style, leather pants wearing, skinny sort of guys. So we were sort of blindsided when we mutually snuck up on each other. Because of our similar theater careers, we became really good friends pretty immediately. Plus, we were the two outsiders in the cast. The evidence room was an existing company with a couple of shows under its belt moving to this new home, and we were the two hired guns. This arrangement saw us banding together during rehearsal, during which we discovered that we also shared a filthy, irreverent sense of humor. It didn't take long, probably a couple of weeks into rehearsals, for us both to realize, "Oh, hang on. Holy crap, I'm really attracted to you." I can certainly say that for myself at any rate. Megan's thoughts might have run with just a modicum of increased elegance. I made the first overtures, although we were both sending pretty clear signals. My first hurdle, strangely enough, was a feeling of insecurity at being so outclassed by Megan. I saw her as a fancy lady who couldn't possibly have an eye for a working jack like myself. She wore fashion shoes, for fuck's sake. In a way, my perceived class difference probably helped matters progress, as I felt like I could grow safely close to Megan without any danger of romantic feelings because of my low station. That dastardly Cupid snuck right up in my shadow and filled me full of arrows. Eventually the penny dropped, and I was understandably in some disbelief. To myself, I thought, "What? No. No way is this happening. Who do you think you are? Is this Beauty and the Beast? She be a lady, the finest of ladies, and you be but a pig and laborer." But it was too late. Far, far too late. Almost nightly, I was saying to Pat Roberts, "This is crazy. I think we like each other." I would call him constantly to say, "Jesus, check out what Megan just said, because she just said the funniest shit." I couldn't believe that a woman that beautiful and sophisticated would say something so wonderfully pornographic about my balls. Things started falling into place, and finally we were becoming really winky and flirtatious with each other. One day, as she was leaving the theater in her Range Rover, I ran out and stopped her. I knocked on the window and climbed in the passenger seat and looked her in the eye, and I said, "This is going on, right? I'm not that smart, but I'm also no dummy. This is happening." She was very old-fashioned and businesslike about it. She said, "Okay, there might be something happening down the road, but I can guarantee you nothing is going to happen before the end of our play. But yeah, I think you're all right." Then we drove to Los Feliz, which means the happy, where we proceeded to park and make out for 2 hours. Beck's Midnight Vultures had just come out, which included the song Beautiful Way, and we played that song on repeat 38 times. Seems like it was go time. We kept it a secret for a while, but got busted opening night. The sound designer spotted us kissing out on the deck that I had built. Man. Brother, I'll tell you, I was head over heels. I was solid gone, baby. But Megan was extremely old-fangled in her courting allowances. It didn't take long before I had moved out of the unfinished basement I was living in and moved in with her, but she stepped us through the process in small increments. I got to take her home and make out on the couch, but then I had to leave. Then I was allowed to start spending the night, but I had to sleep on the couch. Eventually, when I finally got to sleep in the bed, I had to face the wall and behave myself. She did it for real because she wanted to be sure that I was for real. It took veritable calendar months before she, as she puts it, gave up the puss. I had a job at the time hanging lights for Disney Imagineering. I was driving the 40 minutes up Highway 5 to Valencia one morning when it hit me. I remember exactly where I was, that I was going to marry Megan. And I have to say, I was quite pissed off because I hadn't been consulted. Life just dropped it in my lap. You're getting married. She's 11 years older than me, so it wasn't the most likely pairing for that reason and more. Didn't matter. I was hers. I thought, okay, I'm done. I was incredibly happy at this realization, but I was a little angry. As a man, that I hadn't been given the opportunity to weigh the options. I guess I got over it, but not for a solid 30 seconds or so. Looking back on that period, I have to laud Megan and Courtney for their ability to see any goodness in Pat and me. Don't get me wrong, I'm a big fan of both myself and Pat, but in all fairness to us, we were looking like a pretty dubious wager at that point, when our noble wives had the guts to hold their horses, reach down from their regal coaches into the muddy road, haul us to our feet, clean us off, and make men of us. As I'd suspected it would, doing that play with Megan in 2000 really did save my life, in so many more ways than I ever could have fathomed. I guess the moral of the story would have to be, read The Secret, or at least listen to the audiobook. Measure twice, cut once. When I encourage people to pick up a chisel and begin woodworking, I have to remember that I had a pretty solid 12 or so years of tool training before I ever sharpened a chisel myself. But I don't think that should be daunting to anyone who is brand new to the practice. My education was probably accelerated by my existing shop skills, but basic woodworking comes pretty easily, whether or not you've been running a table saw for years. I had spent some time framing houses before learning to build scenery and props and then becoming a full-time scenic carpenter in Chicago. I have always loved building scenery. It holds a magical quality for me, the fabrication of some illusion upon which to place the action of a play or musical to best facilitate the imagination of the audience. Compared to, say, cladding the rafters of a roof in sheets of plywood, building scenic elements can be a lot more fun, containing a playful or whimsical quality that regular construction lacks. Building houses, both in the framing and the finish work, not to mention the cabinetry, is also mighty satisfying, in that one is creating a solidly comfortable dwelling in which people can make their lives. But having become soundly ensnared in theater's web, I thrived best spending my formative years in the scene shop. That is, until I moved to L.A. Lacking the bountiful theater community of Chicago, Los Angeles did not provide me the opportunity to make much of a living building scenery. Sure, there are a multitude of scenery shops for television and film, but the best ones are all run by a union to which I did not claim membership, and I couldn't find a position at the non-union shops I investigated. My problem was that I was too honest with them. I told him up front that I was an actor, and so I'd need to be able to go to auditions and then likely miss work if and when I booked a job. No shop foreman wants to begin a relationship like that, nor should they. My strategy should have entailed a little more smokescreen, as I could have gotten a job and then asked about auditions later once they were crazy about me. I guess I knew better than to depend upon my ability to charm a bunch of carpenters. Whatever the case, I had to revert to basic construction carpentry, picking up work wherever I could. I built some mediocre editing suite tables and shelf units for a friend from plywood and construction lumber. I did some custom built-in work at a sports bar, a couple of closet built-ins for another pal, etc. Then a plum assignment came my way. Kara, an old Defiant pal, was living in a Hollywood Hills apartment building. The landlord, Chuck, wanted a really nice deck built on the hillside below the building. I drew up some ideas and got him to greenlight one of them that had a Frank Lloyd Wright feeling to the railing details. I enlisted another old Defiant pal, Marty McClendon, who had designed a lot of our more incredible sets in Chicago, to help me out, as we had always had a great time building together. We first dug 6 large holes and poured cylindrical concrete piers deep into the ground, upon which to anchor our structure. Next, we built the legs, beams, joists, and cross-bracing of Douglas fir, treated for termite resistance, finally cladding the actual deck in redwood, which is naturally impervious to rot and the elements. It felt fantastic to be outside working, earning some recompense with our brains and muscles instead of sitting around wondering when our agents were going to call with an audition. The railings were last, and they were comprised of 6 panel sections with an interior geometric pattern of rectangles, which was reminiscent of a Frank Lloyd Wright stained glass window. I designed these patterns by simply messing around with different combinations drawn to scale with a ruler on some graph paper until I found the iteration that was most pleasing to mine eye. This was a big moment for me, looking back, as it was the first time that I was filling the role of designer. I'd always enjoyed working alongside great designers in the theater, taking their plans and engineering the best method by which to accomplish their desired results, but now I was wielding the pencil. Once I had perfected my railing design, I then had to deduce the best way to build it, which led Marty and me to our first use of a common woodworking joint known as the shiplap joint. We cut them primarily on the table saw, a tool we had known and loved for many years but had never utilized for cutting joinery. This was a major development that was soon to provide further inspiration. Soon after I had begun courting Megan, a well-heeled acquaintance of hers wanted a really nifty folly built on his property. His exceptionally nice new house in the hills had an extra acre of what was basically parkland tacked onto the backyard. Out in this park, he wanted a cabin where he could go and have a glass of wine with his guests before dinner. Marty and I jumped and took on this project as well, hiring a couple more helpers, and once again we were thrilled to be working on such a substantial structure. We'd begin each day's work at 7 a.m. and drinking our coffee as the morning sun burned off the mist in the trees made us feel like we could have been in the middle of nowhere instead of smack dab in the center of Los Angeles, creating such a satisfying sense of escape from the shitty, superficial grind of the business. Our design was built around a post and beam structure, with some of our first attempts at beefy joinery connecting the 6x6-inch posts. With a hexagonal deck off the front corner, there was plenty of floor space to clad with reclaimed Douglas fir 2x4s that we had salvaged from a 100-year-old house in Santa Monica, igniting our desire to reuse as much of the valuable timber that goes to waste every day as we could. If we as a society properly reclaimed all of the construction lumber heading to the landfill and the bonfire every day, we wouldn't need to cut down another tree for 20 years, if ever. After we finished that cabin, another friend wanted a yoga studio built in her yard in West L.A. By this point, I discovered, mainly in Pasadena, the architecture of Green and Green, who were contemporaries of Frank Lloyd Wright in the early 20th century, and I became completely besotted with their style, which adds some sexy Asian curves to the craftsman or mission aesthetic. My design for the yoga hutch emulated their designs as near as I could afford anyway, and Marty and I were really enjoying our education as we continued to challenge each other to execute more complex designs in joinery. One day, as I was chopping out a humongous mortise with a framing chisel, I realized that this huge mortise and tenon joint that I was creating to join the posts and beams together was also one of the bedrock joints used in antique furniture. I thought, hey, if we can build this structure, then surely we can build a table, which is just a smaller scale version of a post and beam cabin. Another harbinger of the impending change in my carpentry style was instigated by a film job that I got during the construction of the yoga hutch. I had to leave my job site for a few months while I worked on the film, which was nothing short of an asshole move. I left this mostly finished building under construction in the backyard of these nice people while I traipsed around shooting a film. Not the coolest move. I promised myself from there on out I would only build pieces in a workshop where I could give a client a safe lead time so that I could complete their commissions when I was able to without leaving a mess lying around their property. I started driving Megan crazy because everywhere we went, I would be on the floor underneath the old tables looking at the joinery. I was obsessed with the tricks employed by furniture makers over the years to ensure a structure's solidity. A contractor that I knew saw what was happening and recognized my symptoms. He gave me a few issues of Fine Woodworking magazine and said, "If you want to get into this stuff, this is all you need." And sure enough, I got a subscription and was just swept away down a river of knowledge upon which I am still paddling madly. I had guzzled all of the Kool-Aid, reading voraciously of woodworking and then beyond to boat building. If one is bewitched by woodworking, as I am, and one begins a program of study, as I have, then one must first essay the classic joinery. The mortise and tenon, the dovetail, the sliding dovetail, the miter joint, the box joint, the finger joint. Eventually everything breaks down into simple techniques. The entire discipline of working with wood really only comes down to a handful of tools and methods with which you can do damn near anything with wood in three-dimensional space, to the extent of the limitations of your material. Once you master those simple tools and techniques, you can then craft toward whatever item your predilections steer you to. You might want to build bread boxes or bicycles or chess pieces or sailboats, and you can. I was immediately and powerfully drawn to the work of George Nakashima, a Japanese-American woodworker who popularized his table style, consisting of a single slab of a walnut tree with the natural edges retained, resting upon different sculptural varieties of a trestle base. These tables look equally at home in an ancient temple or a modern architectural house, because the slab of wood itself is the work of art. My first attempt was an homage to his Frenchman's Cove table, which his daughter Mira has been producing since she took over the Nakashima operation after her dad passed away. She maintains a very charismatic company in Pennsylvania if you want to see some superb American work. The more I learn about woodworking, the more I am convinced that I don't ever want to decorate my pieces with a lot of man-made gingerbread. Many virtuoso craftspersons work in many styles, and they do some mind-blowing things, with solid wood, in the Federal style, Art Nouveau, Victorian, and others. Not so much for me. I think it's all about creating a piece of furniture that allows the wood itself to draw the focus. What Ma Nature has wrought in the grain and color and figure of a given piece of tree is generally much more magical to me than any dental edge I might adhere to it. Finally finishing the wood, especially with a hand-rubbed oil finish after careful scraping and sanding, simply reveals the story that particular tree has been getting ready to tell us for decades or sometimes centuries. Usually the story is full of twists and surprises and breathtaking beauty, but hopefully the story does not include a chapter about a lag bolt that someone screwed into the tree 80 years ago, only to be rediscovered by your expensive table saw blade. I knew I needed a shop space, but couldn't find anything remotely appropriate and or affordable until one day I was helping my friend Daniel Wheeler, a high-end sculptor and maker of things, to cast Pat Roberts' supine form in plaster, so that Daniel could sculpt a formica-faceted mountain range in the rough shape of Pat's carcass. An amazing piece of loving work, by the way. The sculpture, not Pat's bod. Although, that's not too shabby either. My motorcycle happened to need a jump, so I went to the neighboring warehouse spaces looking for some jumper cables.